So many things are happening in the society or in the world around us. It seems that it would be appropriate for us to take an assessment of the signs of our times. I've never been one to give this type of sermon because it has not been my forte or my gift. I certainly can make observations about the world around. The scriptures do tell us to pay attention, to take note of, to watch, if you would use that particular expression. But so much is happening in so very many quarters of the world. I think we should take a look at what the scriptures insist should be the Christian's perspective, or perhaps I should better say a child of God's perspective, because applying the term Christian to people like Daniel would be inappropriate, because they preceded Christ, you see. So perhaps we should enlarge that to include the children of God. And first I want to turn in this particular sermon to Luke 21. Normally, in these types of messages, you go to Matthew 24, but Luke 21 is a parallel scripture. But I do want us to be careful not to assume all of the things that we have assumed, or things that we take for granted, or things that we feel we know. Because as we look at the signs of our times, there is an important point to be made and to be embraced by all of us. In this passage, Christ is quoted as dealing with an issue on the woman who had the widow's mite, who came up to the temple and dropped what she had and the offering, and he proclaimed that she gave more than those who gave financially more, because she gave of everything that she had versus those who gave merely of their surplus or their extra. That's a very important lesson for us to consider in any deals that we do or any activity that we do. Those who feel that because they have plenty and they give millions, that accrues to them some special privilege, some special favor. There are a number of people who give of everything that they have, which may not, comparatively speaking, be very much at all. So as he is telling them of this story and they're walking about the temple grounds and looking at all the finery there, in verse 6 he says to them in Luke 21, "As for these things which you are looking at, the days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another which will not be torn down." Again, reading from the New American Standard Translation. Now that had to come as a shock. By comparison, it would be like me walking through Wall Street, or you walking through Wall Street today in New York City, or perhaps in Chicago or some other financial capital of the world, and saying, all of these buildings that you see and all the foundations upon which the economic institutions rest will be torn down as the stock market pushes towards 10,000. That's what it would be like. And you would be laughed out the streets. Another Jeremiah. Another flee from the wrath to come. And just look at your bank accounts, my friends, say all of the stockbrokers. You know, I have a mutual fund in which a number of us are involved in, and I remember when we first went into it, this one particular plan, I think you could buy into it at $31. It's more than doubled in 3 years. As just an example of what's happening. And so then to suggest to somebody, you know, all this stuff is going to fall. All of this is going to just be as the wind, like a puff of smoke in the wind. They wouldn't believe you. But it would be just like Jesus Christ walking by the temple and all of the finery there and saying, there will not be one stone left upon another that you see here. Well, then the logical question is what the disciples asked. They didn't laugh, but they perhaps kind of within themselves snickered a bit, saying, teacher, in verse 7, When, therefore, will these things be, and what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? Now, a wise individual, and there are a bunch of folk who like to read the stock market and read the signs of the times so that they will know how to invest, so they will know how to prepare. Do you know that prior to 1929, on that Black Tuesday in October of 1929, there were folk who were not hurt by the stock market crash? They looked at the signs of the times and made preparations. Joseph Kennedy was not hurt by the stock market crash, JFK's father. And there were a number of other folk who were not hurt because they looked at the signs of the time and figured, you know, maybe we ought to be out of this and into something else. Charlie Chaplin comes to mind. He was not hurt by the stock market crash when it crashed because he got out of the stock market just before it crashed, made a bundle, was able to ride out then through the tough times. Now, I only use this as an illustration of how looking at the signs of the times is very important. It's what Christ says we should do. But why did he say that a person has to pay attention? Look at what he says in verse 8. He says, "Take heed that you be not misled." So easy to be misled, to be fooled, to be bamboozled and hoodwinked. "For many will come in my name." And so he identifies that there will be a religious activity associated with these events whereby the temple is going to be destroyed and the status quo is going to be upset. And we've never lived at a more religious time than which we live today. Lots of people claiming not that they are the Savior, as Christ says, and I have it set off in very nice quotes here. He says, "Take heed that you not be not misled, for many shall come in my name," that is, claiming by my authority that I, Jesus, am the Christ. Not that they are Christ, but that I am Christ. And they will, in proclaiming that, deceive many. You cannot go through television and not see somebody talking about getting back to the founding principles or the foundation stones upon which the nation was built, and they will claim that that foundation was Christianity, let alone what's going on within the various churches. So he says, be cautious, be careful. Why does he say it? In verse 9, very clearly. "And when you hear a number of other things, including wars and disturbances, do not be terrified, for these things must take place first. But the end does not follow immediately. For then shall nations rise up against nations." So I decided, you know, I've read this for 30 years. I'm going to look up the word nations and see what it means in the Greek. It just means people. Just people. Are people rising up against people? Within families? It's not this great ethereal idea of, well, you got to get this group of nations and this other group of nations, and they got to go at each other. It's just plain everyday people rising up against each other. We talk about the gang warfare in our inner cities. That certainly is turf battles and people rising against people, but people rise up against each other in economic terms, in sociological terms, all kinds of ways that people are at each other's throats. And Christ predicted it, but many times we overlook it because we're looking for some huge thing to happen. And so we have fed into our thinking when we read these passages about kingdom rising against kingdom. Let's take a quick look at the world. Indonesia, in the news this week. Great unrest. President Suharto, the dictator there, has determined, really, to some degree, maybe he needs to get out. He's quite old. But as last count reported this morning, 409 people have been killed, and the number continues to escalate in Indonesia. Well, why in the world is Indonesia important, and what impact could they possibly have on us way over here? This is a global economy. And we have some vested interest. You hear about all the Americans trying to get out of there? Big names like AT&T. You know, IT&T and all these kinds of big companies are vested over there. And the whole economic upset in the Far East is having an effect and will have an effect on the American economy because international or multinational companies have these vested interests. So it's happening over there in Indonesia. Well, unrest, of course, exists within North Korea. We'll just set that one aside. They're not in the news that prominently at the moment. But India, little old India, well, not so little, 900 million people. I talked to an Indian shopkeeper here a couple of days ago when the news of the bomb and the nuclear testing had gone on, just to get an idea. You know, it's nice to talk to folk from there, to get a perspective. And what he said was, you know, at first he was upset that his nation was involved in it, but he had to rethink it because he says, you know, we're surrounded by the Muslim or the Islamic faith. Pakistan is Islamic, and India is Hindu. This goes back to when Gandhi was attempting to bring some peace to that region and was assassinated ultimately because he tried to make peace between the Muslims and the Hindus, of which he was a Hindu. And he was assassinated. He was shot down in the streets. But then just across the Indian Ocean, all of the Arab community, which is Islamic, is supporting Pakistan. And who's supporting Pakistan? The Chinese. And who's supporting the Indians? The Russians. So the battle and the fighting and the nation against nation, from people against people, but kingdoms against kingdom, yes, is going on. And the U.S. stands there trying to support everybody to bring a balance of peace to everything. And everybody's saying to the paper tiger, get out of our business. The gentleman who I spoke with said that the Indians, the present regime that's in power, will not relinquish. They will not back up. They will not go back because they feel threatened by what the Pakistanis are doing. And so we look at this on the news and say, well, that's way over there and it's not bothering us, and maybe we just should ignore it because we move right along. No, we shouldn't ignore it, but there's a point to why we observe it. And then the Middle East, the muddle in the Middle East. My. People are proclaiming that America is selling out its ally in the Middle East, Israel, for the sake of the Palestinians, who decided that they wanted 33% of land. America suggested 13%. The Israeli says, well, we can only give up 9%, and so there's a stalemate. And feelings are running high, and no resolution in sight. And the vulnerability of the stock market, you can feel the earthquakes. I often wondered about this term, earthquakes. Does it mean simply an earthquake? Or could it be storms? Could it be just the rumblings throughout the society in general? Yes, the earth's shaking, to be certain, but there's more than one way for the earth to shake. When you get a wind going through like a tornado, that's an earthquake, my friends. And they are an increasing number of them, it seems, in the southeast of this country. So there's a new way, maybe, that we have to look at these scriptures and consider this thing of the signs of the times and how we should observe them. But there must be a point to observing it. Why do we pay attention to it? What's the point? Is it merely to spout off about them? To aggrandize ourselves and proclaim how much we know about them? But is there something deeper? Here's what Christ said in verse 9 again. Look at it. Don't be terrified, for these things must take place, but the end is not fully yet. Verse 12. But before all these things, as he talks about earthquakes and plagues and signs of the heavens, they will lay hands on you and will persecute you and deliver you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings, governors, for my name's sake. It will lead, verse 13, to an opportunity for your testimony. That's the point of watching. That's the point of proclaiming these events to the world, is that it gives us an opportunity to give our testimony. Further in verse 14 it says, so make up your minds. make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves. You know, have it all worked out, what you're going to say, whenever you are called into question for the things you believe. I want to pause from Luke 21 at this point to take us back to an example of what I mean, of another man who looked at the signs of his time, Daniel, the fifth chapter. I really want us as the church to take a look at this issue. Ever since I've been involved with the church from the mid-60s and early part of the 60s, when we were told to watch the signs of the time, and there were going to be riots in the streets and blood in the streets and up to the horse's bridle and all of the dire predictions. There were riots in the streets. I was in one in Detroit, you know, in 1967. All of those things happened, but the end was not yet. What was the point? Now, for me, it caused me to alter my life, to change the direction of my life, and then to associate with the group of people that were proclaiming to the rest of the world to be aware, to be alert, and maybe change their lives. But somehow that gets lost in the mix when we begin looking at the signs of the time and shake our heads in disbelief. But here is an example of a man who was a slave. He had been taken captive. Of course, you know who Daniel is and was. Daniel was a Hebrew child, a young man who was taken by the Babylonians along with a host of other people. And, of course, the famous three, we call them the big three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those were their Babylonian names, but their Hebrew names of Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael were very important names. Daniel's name was changed in the Babylonian tongue to Belteshazzar. But Daniel was a man with a gift, an ability to look and to see and to interpret dreams and essentially see the signs of the times. And we know what he was able to do with Nebuchadnezzar, but now we are brought to a point in time in history in the fifth chapter where he has to interact with the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar named Belshazzar. Belshazzar was holding a great feast, we learn in verse 1 of chapter 5, for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of 1,000 and having a grand old time. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple which was at Jerusalem in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. This is something that even Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't have done. He merely put them in storage and respected them because of his respect for Daniel, but Belshazzar, his grandson, didn't have that regard. He did not realize that there was a Most High God who controls everything and who would take umbrage with this particular act. He did it. And they drank the wine in verse 4 and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And suddenly, in verse 5, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the poster of the wall of the king's palace. The king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. And the king became alarmed with this hand writing on the wall. His face grew pale, verse 6, and his thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints went slack, and his knees began to knock together. I guess if we could look behind closed doors throughout capitals of the world, if we could be a fly on the wall at the G8 conference that's going on in England at the present time, there would be some knees knocking. There would be some people a little weak. Because Pakistan said, your response to what the Indians have done is a little weak. And the Indians say, we will not be deterred by any kind of sanctions you can impose upon us because we are going to protect our interests. Well, there's some knees knocking. They may not look like it in public because they will say all the right words, but I bet you there's some Belshazzars as we look at the signs of the times. So the king called up in verse 7 all of his conjurers and all the people who were supposed to know what's going on, to see if he could get an interpretation of this inscription that had been written on the wall. And they told him, no, we can't do it. Verse 9, the king was very alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. Then the queen entered into the discussion. And she says, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. And then she begins to tell about a man who was probably in retirement in verse 11, Daniel. Why was he in retirement? Well, he was obviously very close to Nebuchadnezzar. When Nebuchadnezzar died, evil Marmaduke became king. That was the father of Belshazzar. But there were other couple of little intermediary reigns of 9 months here and a few weeks there before Belshazzar came to the throne. And so perhaps Daniel, in his faithfulness to God, in the midst of everything that's going on around him, was off in retirement, perhaps. And so she tells the king, Belshazzar, look, there's a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, your grandfather, illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. At some point in time, even on our blocks, in our neighborhoods where we live, people are going to ask us, what do you think about what's going on? They've already probably asked you. I've never been polled. Anybody in here ever been in a poll? You know, like Gallup calling up or anybody? I figure that must be a select few people. But we do talk about what's happening in Washington, don't we? We do give an opinion about it. And we can give opinions about it, but what is that opinion based upon? Just our feelings? Is it filtered through the scriptures? Is it because we have an extraordinary spirit and insight like Daniel to be able to say, thus says the Lord? That's why we watch. That's why we pay attention. So that when called upon, we can exercise that extraordinary spirit within us. As we approach the day of Pentecost, we need to think about that. Because many times we just shoot from the lip. And not are motivated and guided by the power of God's Spirit to express God's view of the signs of the time. And be careful. Be careful. That's what Christ says. Many will come in my name proclaiming that, yes, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ and deceive many. Be careful. Do not impose upon others our opinions that has not been filtered or have not been filtered through the Word of God. So Daniel is called upon, and we know the rest of the story. Daniel says, of course, that, yeah, I can do this. Verse 20, look at what Daniel says as we break into the thought. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud, this is speaking now of Nebuchadnezzar, that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was that of the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. So there are going to be some folk in charge of nations who will have to come to this awareness. And Daniel here reminds Belshazzar that his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had to go through this. And we know that this is his grandfather from a statement in the book of Jeremiah. Let's see if I can remember from my mind. Jeremiah 27, verse 3. I'll check that later afterwards services to make sure of it. But this is the grandson, Belshazzar, of Nebuchadnezzar. In verse 22 it says, yet you, his son, his grandson, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. I like that. there are a lot of folk who have occupied the White House who proclaim their Christianity or their belief in God all the way back to the very beginning. And I wonder around the world how many people have some view of God. Certainly, if we were to kind of press them on it, they would proclaim, we know about God. And we believe that God existed and that he's the creator and so forth and so on. But something is missing in the mix as we look at the signs of the time. Verse 23 says, "But you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubine, have been drinking wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand, but the God in whose hands are your life breath, and your ways you have not glorified." Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written on it. The handwriting on the wall, "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." And then he gives them the interpretation of it. "You've been weighed in the balance and found wanting." To a large measure, those in the Americas, the United States of America, and maybe through Canada and other parts of the Western world, have we been weighed in the balance and found wanting? How do we determine that? How do we measure that? And by extension to all of those associated with us, allied with us, have we been weighed in the balance and found wanting? Who would God really be upset with? Those who proclaim to observe the Sabbath in the Holy Lands and do not? Perhaps we ought to think about that, because one of the big burning internal fires within the nation of Israel, from the Hasidim or the Hasidic Jews versus just the everyday Jews born there by birth, is the Sabbath. You don't go into the Hasidic region driving your vehicle. You'll be stoned. But they are a minority in the rest of Israel that sit out on the beaches and go to the theaters and have their shops. Who is God more upset with? Those who claim to be his people? Worth looking at, worth analyzing, worth considering when we talk about the geopolitics and what's going on. But here's an example of the signs of a time. When Daniel stood up and spoke and proclaimed that this kingdom of Babylon would fall, and the next chapter describes it. We won't go into it. That's when Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian, the Medo-Persian Empire, came in that very night. We're told, I think, in Josephus that they diverted the water. There was a walled city. Babylon had all these walls and gates around it, you know, and they diverted the water. The river Euphrates, I do believe, that went through Babylon. You know where Babylon is today? It's where Iraq is today. So we understand this has really historical impact as we take a look at all of those regions of the world. But when the water was diverted, they were able to go underneath the gate and come in to the city of Babylon and take it over, because God determines who wins, who loses, who reigns, who does not. So as we analyze what's going on in India and Pakistan and all of the regions of the world, we have to come to that conclusion. God has a plan. Not me, not you, not our feeble assessment in our own human eyes, but there has to be a point. Now, shifting just a bit, God's revelation to his people is always with a fine point to it. Always. If we'll go back to 2 Timothy, just want to go back there quickly. Because when we're assessing the signs of the time and times in which we live, we can look at geopolitics, global politics, and the economic situations as they exist, and we can have great chagrin about it. But bring it back to a more everyday, mundane circumstance. As Timothy is told by the Apostle Paul, and again, in this particular translation, I like the King James, that in the last days perilous times shall come. I like that, but here's how it's written in this translation. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. Difficult times. And it goes on to name a number of things that we can see very clearly. Men will be lovers of self. Oh, really? The me generation. The me generation. How many companies can I take over? Let's see. I want to be bigger than anybody, says Bill Gates. I want to vanquish everybody. I want to take over this company and take over that company. Is that not me generation? But I know. In economic terms, we say, well, that's the American way. Competition. The strong survive. And all of those phony principles and things that we talk about in certain ways. We ignore the reality of what God says when he set up the nation of Israel. Do not gather in from all of the corners of your field. Do not glean from every part of it for yourself. Leave some for the person who walks by and for the fatherless and the widow and take care of them in that fashion. That's how Ruth was able to meet Boaz, because she was out gleaning in his field because of the principle that Boaz lived by and all of the plenty he had. Maybe some of the corporate leaders need to think about that. But lovers of ourselves, lovers of money. Oh, have we ever lived at a time when that were not true, like it is today? Yes, lots of money. Get as much as you can get, no question about it. Boastful, arrogant, revilers. The airwaves in this country are filled with revilers. We use terms that would never have been used in polite company to refer to high officials in the land. And we wonder why our children's mouths are so vile and filthy. It comes across television. It comes across the radio. And then we justify it. He deserves it. And we think there's no penalty to pay, that there's nothing that we have to be held accountable for, because we are righteous. We come in the name of the Lord. We proclaim that Jesus is Lord and deceive many. Well, he goes on to talk in these terms of being disobedient to parents. In my show, where people call in, we're talking about parental control when it comes to the educational process. I'm just amazed that parents don't even know what classes their students are taking. That they have abrogated responsibility, so they could tell the child, well, I want you to really get your studies, but children don't obey. I wish that I would have, because I may not be standing here talking to you today, but I would say that it never crossed my mind that I could trick my mother when it came to getting my grades and getting my schoolwork together. I failed two classes in my entire school years. Both of them were at the high school level. One was biology, one was French. I was just goofing off. And I didn't want her to know. I just confessed. Yeah, I gave her a false report card, because the beating would have been far worse than her knowing. Well, she came to know anyhow, and the beating still came. So, I mean, she just has this way of finding out things. But being disobedient to parents, that's just the way it is today. You see it in the malls, don't you? Don't you see how our children respond to their parents and the shows that they put on, falling out and having their temper tantrums and so forth, and parents say things like, time out, time out. Yes, time out, all right. You know, I got some time out for you right here. I think I told you once my mother was singing in the church choir, and I was cutting up on the front row. I had been less than 5 years of age. She came out of the choir stand in her robe and whacked me right there in front of everybody and went back to the choir stand. I didn't act up anymore. See, it was no time out. No psychological adjustment. No, I might bruise his psyche and all the mumble jumble that goes on today. But Paul understood it. He talked about the signs of the time. Perilous days will come. Dreadful, horrible days will come. Difficult times will arise. For in verse 3, they will be unloving. Well, I just passed over ungrateful in the previous verse, and unholy. You know, I don't know about you, but
I'm amazed at how infrequently people respond to you holding the door open for them. Just a simple act of kindness. They just go by and say nothing. Ungrateful. It's a simple thing, thank you. And I don't mean to be, this may sound chauvinistic, but I find that sometimes women don't even like you to do that because it's like a demeaning thing. It's like, I don't need a man to hold the door open for me. You know what I mean? It's just amazing of the times in which we live. But in verse 3, we are unloving and irreconcilable. Malicious gossips. Don't let me get started on that, because this church has been a recipient of that, and we've been a participant in that. Malicious gossips. The worst invention is the telephone. And then I thought, when that was the worst, along comes the internet. There must be something else down the road. But the signs of the times are what we're talking about. When we look at this, what's the point? Verse 4, they're treacherous and reckless or heady. I think the King James had it. Conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. We've got so many more television stations and cable outlets and plush movie houses. Of course, around in this area, we don't really know how plush. Just go to one of the major metropolitan areas sometimes and go to some of these major starplexes and see the unbelievable, it looks like Babylon and the Hanging Gardens, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Every kind of distraction, game rooms and floral designs and great huge statues and pictures. And it's no big deal. Verse 5, holding to a form of godliness. A form. And people rally to the form and say, oh, isn't this religious? Isn't this spiritual? Look, there are the Ten Commandments tacked on the courthouse door. Isn't that a religious move? Then you ask the question, do you have to keep those commandments? Oh, yeah, sure you do. Yeah, yep, you got to keep them. That's why we have them. We want to know that we believe in those. Well, do you keep that fourth one? Oh, but that was changed. And so we live in a time when we have to evaluate the signs of the time from a biblical perspective, because there's a point to our watching. There's a point to our analysis, because God did not give it to us just to bask in it, to satiate ourselves with it, and pretend that we are something special because we have insight. Although they have denied its power in verse 5, and avoid such men as these, the scriptures say. And it goes on to give this example of Jannes and Jambres who opposed Moses. But it brings us down to verse 13. Here's the point. But evil men and imposters will proceed from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. The situations that we could look at in India and Pakistan and Indonesia and the Middle East, or wherever we choose to look, the White House, the courthouse, your house, or my house. Evil men and imposters will proceed from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived, as we analyze the time, just like Daniel was able to do in his day. In verse 14, here's the point. You, however, continue in the things you have learned and become convinced of, knowing from whom you have learned them, and that from childhood you have known the sacred writings. Here's Paul writing to Timothy and reminding him what he should be grounded in and what his preaching should be grounded in, and why it is that he should assess the signs of the times and what it should be filtered through. He says, from a childhood you have known the sacred writings, which was the Old Testament as we know it, which are able to give you the wisdom and leads to the salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. It's about getting to salvation. We don't watch the signs of the time just to say, well, you know, isn't that awful? Isn't that just terrible? Look at what they are doing. The point is that salvation is supposed to be the result of our analysis, of our watching, and to try to convince some others. Look at what it says as it goes on. All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction and training in righteousness, that the man of God may be adequate, appropriate and proper, equipped for every good work. And many times in the past we used to say tisk tisk about what something was going, what was happening. Isn't it awful how those people are performing? Isn't it just terrible? Look at that sin over there. But the point has to be for equipping us for good work. Back to Daniel, the 12th chapter. The summation of Daniel's watching the signs of his time, and bear this in mind. Daniel, when brought as a captive from Babylon, to Babylon from Israel, from Judah, he was important through the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and evil Marmaduke and Belshazzar, but then he was held over by the Medes and the Persians, by Darius and Cyrus, to be officials. So much so that in the 6th chapter of Daniel, they conspired. Some of the leaders in the Persian Empire, or the Medo-Persian Empire, under Darius, decided to conspire against Daniel. They knew Daniel believed in the Most High God, and that Daniel was a prayer to God, so they decided, we'll pass a law. The law of the Medes and the Persians that can't be revoked. We'll go to the king, Darius, and get him to sign into law this reality that if anybody prays to anybody who is not an official god of the Medo-Persian Empire, they should be thrown into the den of lions. And Daniel was thrown into the den of lions because he refused to obey such a rule, a law. And of course, Darius was upset that his people had conspired and tricked him in such a way, so when Daniel came unscathed out of the lion's den, guess what happened? Well, you know the story. He threw in all of those people who conspired against Daniel, and they became lion's meat. Daniel went through a lot viewing and proclaiming the signs of the time. So when we get to the 12th chapter, in verse 1, it becomes very critical how we analyze this. Now, at that time, Michael, this is the archangel Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, this is being quoted to Daniel, he will arise, Michael will, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, Daniel, your people, everyone who is found written in the book will be rescued. The question to us today is, as we analyze the signs of the time, is your name written in the book? That's the point. It's not enough to proclaim, oh, ain't it awful? Look at what's going on over there. Look at this terrible situation and prophesying and predicting, well, you know, the stock market's going to fall. It hasn't fallen yet. Oh, it will fall. I don't know when. I cannot be a prognosticator on that score. It will fall. The prophecies say that people will be throwing their gold in the streets. But sometime it's going to happen. But if my name is not written in the book of life, what's the point of my prediction? What's the point of my saturating myself in the idea that I have some inside knowledge? Daniel is being told here that your people, the people who identify with you, Daniel, the people who are part of the aggregate of the children of God, your people, everyone who is found written in the book will be rescued. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. That is a confirmation of what Paul was later to write in 1 Corinthians 15, that we shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Behold, I show you a mystery, he said. So as we look at this, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. But verse 3, but those who have insight, who can assess the signs of the times, as it were, will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. I like that, because that's a confirmation of what you could read in Genesis 15 and verse 5. Read it sometime. That's a promise to Abraham that your seed, Abraham, will be as the sands of the seashore and more numerous than the stars of heaven, if you could count them. There's a thread that winds its way through the scriptures, and when you string that thread together, you come up with a beautiful picture. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness. That's the point. If we utilize the idea of watching just simply for self-aggrandizement, we have missed the mark. We have missed the point. We only put a spotlight on what's going on in the world to awaken in people a desire to be saved, to come into the fellowship, to be one of those stars as the brightness of heaven. It is not so that we can impress somebody with the totality of our knowledge. That's what it has to be. That's what the scriptures say. And I think we have ignored it, have overlooked it. Lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. That's what Abraham was promised. He was given a promise in the 12th chapter of Genesis, and it was expanded in the 15th chapter to include this terminology of, if you could number the stars of heaven, then you can number those who will be of your seed. And how do you become a seed of Abraham? Do you go through the same types of things that Abraham went through? Yes. Do you go through the things that Daniel went through? Yes. Do you go through the things that Timothy was told he was going to have to go through? Yes. And the end result is to be like the stars of heaven, the signs of the time. Are only analyzed and only important to us if we utilize them to secure our names in the book of life and to make a commitment to make sure that there are others who will shine as brightly. Thy kingdom come.